This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Picture that super soft t-shirt you love sleeping in. The one that gets softer and softer the more you wear it. Now you can bring that same lived-in softness to your entire bed with Signature Vintage Wash Sheets from Boll & Branch. This all-new collection is even softer than your favorite t-shirt, with a distinctly relaxed look and feel for your best night's sleep. Just like all Boll & Branch bedding, Signature Vintage Wash Sheets start with the highest quality, 100% organic cotton. The lived and feel comes from a small batch washing process, creating a level of softness you've never felt before. And it's not just the feel. Boll & Branch mastered the laid-back aesthetic using a special technique that creates the well-loved look you'll find with vintage jeans. And true to the Boll & Branch hallmark, Signature Vintage Wash Sheets get softer and softer with every wash. Right now, you can get 15% off your first order with promo code ODYSSEY and save on their most relaxing sheets. So head to BollAndBranch.com today. That's B-O-L-L and Branch.com.
Welcome to the Sports Media Podcast. I'm your host, Richard Deitch. My producer is Patrick Antonetti. Our guest in this episode is Louisa Thomas, who is a fantastic staff writer for The New Yorker. Does a lot of interesting sports stories, both for their magazine and online. You probably certainly find more of her stuff online, newyorker.com. And she just recently had a great profile of Nikola Jokic, the Nuggets multiple-time MVP, which is just a really, really masterclass in writing. I highly recommend that. So we got into a lot of fun stuff about how people respond when The New Yorker wants to do a sports profile. Lucy used to work at Grantland as well, so she has some unique experience working for two pretty interesting places. So without any further ado, let's go to our interview with Louisa Thomas of The New Yorker. All right, as I said at the top, I'm very excited to have this guest on. To me, one of the really great voices when it comes to writing sports in the United States. As I mentioned earlier, Louisa Thomas is a staff writer at The New Yorker, the author of three books. Check out Louisa, The Extraordinary Life of Mrs. Adams. I will ask her about that book because it's kind of interesting to me. And with that, I welcome Louisa Thomas to the Sports Media Podcast. Louisa, hello.
Thanks so much for having me.
Of course. All right. So, you to me represent a really interesting person in the space, and a lot of it is because of where you're writing at the moment. The New Yorker is just an interesting place to read sports, whether it goes back to Roger Angel or wherever. It's you write many times online, and there's a certain style and a certain length there. And then obviously other times, what The New Yorker is famous for, you are given length and you can do an in-depth profile, as you did with Nikola Jokic, which is just a phenomenal piece of writing. And so I want to start here. How do you find or figure out what stories you want to write in a given week or month?
It's sort of a multi-pronged process, I would say. For the longer pieces, it's actually... in some ways, it's a bit of a challenge because The New Yorker does not have the same sort of pull in the sports world that obviously like a Sports Illustrated or The Athletic or even some of the sort of glossier magazines like GQ. When I reach out to an agent or someone and say I'd like to profile this person, I often don't get a response, or I get a sure, we'd be happy to do it as long as we can have the cover. And I have to explain that the cover this week of The New Yorker is like a sketch of a dog on a skateboard. And so we don't do the sort of kind of big photo shoots that a lot of athletes teams seem to be looking for these days. So it can actually be kind of a challenge to get buy-in from an athlete if I'm going to do a profile. So we have to be a little bit like intentional about who we're going to be right about. And there's also a bit of a tension when we think about the New Yorker's audience, because it's not generally like a super sports savvy audience, certainly for the magazine. Online, there's sort of more, there's a little bit more kind of leniency. I'm allowed to get a little bit nerdier. When I was writing that Jokic piece, for instance, we had a big debate over whether or not I could take for granted whether or not our readers knew what a triple-double was. You know, that's the kind of like level that I sort of am operating in. Whereas when I'm writing online, I can sort of like write a little bit more about, you know, analytics and also kind of assume a little bit more knowledge and interest, even though I think I'm also always cognizant of the fact that a lot of the readers are not your typical sports fan. And a lot of the focus is on some idea or the writing itself. I really care about the writing itself. I probably over attend to the writing, but that's also, I feel like, what I'm sort of bringing to the table. I'm not sort of embedded in a lot of these teams or, you know, specific sports. So that's sort of what I can do. Maybe I can give a lot of attention to something that maybe someone who's writing on deadline, in a more concentrated kind of a different way, who has to sort of communicate more information. Maybe they don't have the sort of time and space to do that.
Isn't it fascinating that, you, if you were writing a piece, let's say, on some professor who has discovered something new in AI, or you wanted to profile an artist or a writer, and the New Yorker calls, mm-hmm. like literally that could be life-changing. Like that call can, right? Where if you're calling, I'm just going to make this up, right? The University of Alabama, because you happen to want to write about a football player, and they're like, what's the New Yorker? Or like again, like, you know, is a photographer coming? Can you guarantee us the cover? It's just so fascinating to me because, you know, you worked for Grantland. So you also understand the other side of when a, you know, a mainstream sports publication calls, and that can excite like the apparatus in sports.
Totally.
So I just find it hilarious that you have to deal with it on your end, that that some traditional sports places, just, you know, how they react to the New Yorker is so different than when I worked at Sports Illustrated. Like, you know, we'd be used to, if we were calling some team or some SID about saying that, you know, we want to profile someone.
Yeah, it's actually, it's very amusing to me. I mean, it's funny to me too, because like I grew up reading the New Yorker and loving the New Yorker. And, you know, it was a bit jarring when I started writing for here to sort of like realize that, you know, saying that I was calling from the New Yorker just like didn't actually mean anything. In fact, it sort of was like I was asking for, I had to explain, you know, what this place was and what we were about. And yeah, it's amusing sometimes, frustrating at other times for sure.
One of the things that when I was at Sports Illustrated is really helpful is sometimes these like consumer marketing executives would come in and they would really tell us, like, in pretty intricate data, like who was reading the magazine, like the age of the person, the income of the person, what sports they liked, where they might have lived, their political leanings, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm sure the New Yorker has that data for their magazine, but that must be very tricky for you, because the data probably is not sports geared at all. So when you're doing the pieces that you do, and we'll get into some of them, both either for online or for the magazine itself, like, are you thinking at all about who's reading, or do you just do the piece and whoever ends up reading it ends up reading it?
I think that there is more attention to the prospective audience for the magazine pieces. You know, we really want to be, the real estate in the magazine is very precious, right? So they're not that many stories in any given week. And we have some of like the best writers in the world kind of jockeying for that position. So I think that there's a kind of, we try to be very careful about what pieces are going to land in the print pieces. Like they have to kind of meet a certain number of criteria. So is the person really important, or is there a kind of idea behind it that we can teach someone, you know, teach a broad audience, and they'll find it interesting. Like I wrote about, over the summer, I wrote about Daniel Bard, a baseball player who is not, you know, a famous baseball player, not the best baseball player, although he's, you know, he's very good, but he had a very compelling, interesting story. He got the yips. He was a very, very good reliever for the Boston Red Sox, got the yips, trawled the minors for 5 years, retired, came back as a kind of mental coach for the Arizona Diamondbacks. And then through the process of sort of helping these young sort of, you know, down on their luck, you know, minor leaguers, kind of rediscovered how to throw, and then also like rediscovered some of the joy of baseball, and became, you know, one of the top relievers in baseball again. And that was sort of an easy like narrative to sort of pitch. And also we could, you know, learn about the yips and learn about this mind body connection and stuff that is kind of naturally interesting. And then during the process of like reporting that story, he actually got the yips again. So that was like another kind of compelling twist. So like, that's the kind of story where I'm sort of pitching a story, as opposed to like a person. Where when I pitch Nikola Jokic, it's very, easy to say, well, like this is the best basketball player, you know, in the world. New Yorker readers, he's not that famous. New Yorker readers might not like, there's value in introducing New Yorker readers to who he is, how he's changing the game, what he's doing. And also, by the way, like, he's just a pleasure to write about. Like, that part of that pitch was just like, I really want to write about this person, because like I said, I really care about the writing side of it. And I knew that, like, that was the piece I could just kind of like write the hell out of, you know. That piece was not going to like be great because I was going to get any special access. In fact, I got no access, and I went into it, no access to him, I should say. I went into it knowing that, but I made the pitch that like, this is a piece that I can just like, I can like really lean into like the writing of it. And I really love that. And so that was the sell.
Let's get into that piece for a little bit. The Jokic piece ran in late February, and it, you know, as the kids would say, it went viral. Like, it really popped on, certainly on social media, got a lot of attention. And like you said, it's not like he gave you quotes in this piece that, you know, were headline stuff. In fact, he didn't talk for it. And so sort of the why I think this piece was so well received was just your writing and your sort of detail and your eye for what makes him unique. From your perspective, why do you think people gravitated to that piece? Why do you think that piece struck with people?
Well, thank you for saying so many nice things about it. I had a lot of fun doing it, and I think that people responded to that. Actually, I think that there was a sort of sense of, you know, it's interesting because the New Yorker very rarely, I mean, as I kind of alluded to when I was speaking about how I choose stories, it's very rare to be able to write a print profile without getting access. Usually there has to be some compelling reason for it. Like, they'll profile, you know, Clarence Thomas or someone who is not going to talk, but there is like an obvious, you know, social or political or cultural reason why like the New Yorker reader should learn about this person, even though they're not getting sort of special access. In this case, we knew that he wasn't going to give access because he doesn't give access to anyone. So there wasn't the sort of consideration, well, you know, he's going to talk to the New York Times Magazine, but not to us, or even to GQ and not to us. I mean, maybe he will someday, but I was pretty confident that the piece was going to come out before, you know, we were, you know, some great interview came out. So, and I found that kind of liberating, actually. Like, you know, I have certain strengths as a reporter and writer. And I would say that probably like following someone around for a few days and sort of, you know, jotting the, I can do that, but it's not my favorite part of the process. And it was kind of actually nice to sort of not be like trapped by a mediocre interview, you know, sort of compelled to use whatever material I had gotten, you know, through that interview, just because I'd gotten it. I actually found it sort of like helpful in some ways. I know that sounds very strange, but it's true. And I think that people, so I think that people sort of had the right expectation. I was very upfront about it too. I wasn't sort of like, oh, I'm going to talk to him. And then you sort of finish the piece wondering like, wait a second, why did you talk to him? I think also the real thing is that like, I tried to be like a little bit funny, but funny in the way that I can be, which is not like a, you know, bada bing kind of comic, sense, but like, I just tried to have so much fun with it. I think he's really funny. I think the whole situation is funny. I think sports are funny. And I was just like went into this wanting to have fun. That's something I've actually been trying to do. I don't know if you want to get into like the arc of my writing career, but like in the last, I feel like in the last 6 months, I've actually been like made a sort of very kind of, I've been very intentional about like wanting to have a little bit more fun. I feel like the world is a dark place sometimes. And I often like had pushback. I do push back against the idea that like sports are some sort of escape fantasy that are sort of not in enmeshed in the sort of dark realities of American life. Absolutely. Like that's not true, you know, but at the same time, they are an escape, you know, from the dark realities of American life in a lot of ways. And I think that there's real value to finding like pleasure in them. And this was like a story in which there was just so much pleasure to be found. And I didn't even need to search very hard for it. It was like just right there. And so I think that there was a kind of hunger for that. And that's one of the things that people responded to. Does that make sense?
It does. Yeah. First of all, I agree with you on sports. It's a kind of a interesting and weird thing in that on the one hand, sports connects to everything in society, whether it's race or gender, economics, you know, really like important things. And those who sort of have always posited like, you know, sports aren't political, sports aren't this and sports aren't that. It's always been bullshit. It's all related to that. That said, we're so inundated on an hourly basis, it feels like, by information and stimuli and often horrible information and stimuli, that it does serve as an escape for many people. And that's a very, very valuable thing in a hard world. So I'm with you on that. Depending on your POV, you can approach sports in different ways. And I do think at the moment, there's probably less people who are approaching it as the pleasure of sports. And this probably, I think in some ways, maybe that's why your article hit, because it's not like, one, it's not like a hardcore NBA profile where you're sort of breaking down why, you know, like analytically why this guy is so unique, or, you know, you're comparing him to every other historical figure. You're sort of just like, the reason why I really liked it is you're kind of just like a fly on the wall. And sort of just being like, this guy does not look like LeBron James or or Michael Jordan, but yet his greatness and genius is like through the roof. And sort of like why is this happening? One thing that I just like, just as sort of obviously someone who's in the business, because I could totally relate, you put in there that you emailed to Serbian agent, who's he's a guy who's brought a lot of Eastern Europeans to the NBA, and you clearly made, I'm sure, what was a very thoughtful pitch about, hey, I work for the New Yorker, I'd like to talk about him. And he basically responds back, he doesn't speak with the media. That's it. Goodbye. Right?
It was great. It was funny because I had emailed like Bebo Baskets like informational. Like I hadn't even emailed him directly. This was actually in 2022. I wanted to write about Jokic for years. Which is also one of the reasons why I had so much fun doing it. This is like a piece that I felt like was like, I've been writing in some sense for, you know, for 4 years. But so in 2022 is when the summer 2022 is when I first emailed him. He'd actually responded to me. He was like, yeah, I'm Jokic's agent. I was like, oh, great. He's going to be interested. Like, and then I email him, you know, immediately respond. And I immediately, like within 5 seconds, I get that, you know, one line dismissal. It was brutal. And I loved it. I thought, I was like, okay, great. Now I can do it. But I've got to wait. I've got to actually really convince my bosses that they should give me the space to do it. And once Jokic, you know, I was quietly making the push, and when the Nuggets won the championship, you know, I got the green light.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
One of the things that I've seen you write about, certainly like over the last couple of months, and I happen to know that you are a big viewer and fan of tennis, because I actually remember seeing you once at the U.S. Open, and I've just read you over the years to know that you love that sport. You've also written a lot about basketball lately, it seems to me, whether it's Jokic, Caitlin Clark, Wembanyama. Do you find that, like, again, maybe I'm incorrect on this, but if someone was going to ask me, like, what are the two sports you enjoy the most, I would put basketball and tennis pretty high on that list. Is that the case, or have you just found that the people you've written about in those sports, you just happen to find particularly compelling?
Absolutely. I would say tennis is my favorite sport to write about, and probably to watch as well. And I wish I wrote about it more. And basketball is definitely a high on the list. They're both sports in which, I mean, tennis is like the ultimate writer sport, in my opinion, because it's so, you know, it's an individual sport. The sort of drama of the sort of like one-to-one confrontation is like so immediate. You can see the faces of the players. Ultimately, like what I'm writing about is just people. I really like believe that I'm writing about sports, but I'm using sports as a way to write about, to write about people under pressure. And tennis, that's just so immediate. But in basketball, you can also like, you can get there pretty quickly because you can see the players' faces. It's a limited number of people on the court. And there you have the sort of like added benefit of seeing interactions and these like dynamics. And you know, that's harder in football for like all the obvious reasons. Like when you watch football, not only when you're watching on TV, but you know, even more so when you're in a press box, it's like, you're watching the sort of like army formations, right? Players are wearing helmets, you know, you can't really sort of, there's such like team games that to talk about strategy or talk about kind of tactics is sort of like, you end up really sort of having to let go of some of the sort of like more psychological kind of, and a lot of that is like bullshit anyway. And especially in football. In fact, I've sort of had a fun time writing about like momentum, before the Super Bowl. But you know, in tennis, I really feel like it's actually like valid to write about, you know, this sort of way, like choking, for instance. There is a very clear way in which you can see a player tightening and you can not only see it on their face, but you can see it in their way their body is moving, right? Whereas like, it's much harder to write about choking, or to write about, you know, kind of being in the flow, you know, in a basketball game, but certainly in a football game, like those kind of things, the stuff I really love, you know, writing about like, or thinking about in terms of like human psychology, you have to be a little bit more careful when you're talking about these like big team sports than when you're talking about like a sort of, more sort of like visceral kind of, competition like tennis. Does that make sense?
It does. Do you, are you covering the U.S. Open, you think, this year? Because it's not that far from you're an East Coaster, and obviously it's not that far.
Yeah, I try and go to the U.S. Open every year. I mean, back in my Grantland days, I went to a lot of tennis tournaments. I've been to the Cincinnati Open and the Wimbledon and the, you know, Miami and Indian Wells and, you know, and I would always go to the U.S. Open. And now I have, I have two small kids. And I don't have the expense account that I used to.
That's right.
Really I try, but I do go to the U.S. Open every year and I love, and you know, it's funny because then I also, there's a writer named Jerry Marzorati, who's wonderful. Writer,
yeah.
Who's
Times the guy.
Yeah. At the Times. And he writes about, tennis for the New Yorker, and you know, he's a friend of mine. So we will sort of like correspond, like, what are you writing about? You know, we sort of, coordinate our interests, and we would often, both write about the finals for, Off the Slams. But the New Yorker is moving a little bit away from that. Actually, that kind of reaction piece. It was a little bit odd that we had these, like, you know, because that's actually also just the way the New Yorker works, is that like, it's still a weekly publication. It doesn't have a big weekend presence, for instance. So to like marshal the resources of, you know, every web piece gets fact checked and copy edited just like any, you know, magazine piece. So to sort of like, you know, coordinate this like weekend team of fact checkers and copy editors, you know, to do like a blog post about the, you know, women's French Open final or the men's French Open final for that matter. you know, it just sort of like didn't make a lot of sense in the end. So we're sort of moving away from that. And I'm a little bit sad about that because I really kind of like cherish those, you know, that sort of exercise of sitting down and like in a few hours, like writing something fluent and intelligent and fun about, you know, one of the Grand Slam finals was always like one of my favorite sort of like markers of the seasons. So, but I will definitely write something about the US Open and maybe, you know, this sort of shift away from the sort of like responsive blog posts will let me write something a little bit more like at length or thoughtful or, you know, ideas oriented than just the sort of like reactive posts that I did, let's say after Sinner won the Australian Open. But I love writing about Sinner after he won the Australian Open. Like it's going to be a little bit sad for me when, you know, the French Open comes and like, maybe I'm not writing that sort of, that's the exact same piece. Even though it can be challenging. Cause like, frankly, I've written about like Djokovic winning, you know, the same match, like an untold number of times. So it probably makes sense.
Yeah. But, I like the burgeoning Sinner Alcaraz, rivalry.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I mean, that will get its due attention in the New Yorker. It has to, it will, I promise.
Yeah. I'm sure. Maybe yeah. That's later. Do you have any kind of like, you know, The Athletic, I mean, we loosely have to sort of write a certain amount of stories. It's a little better now that there's sort of less, like hard guidelines. There were though, certainly when I started there, are you like, when do they expect a whatever number of like pieces from you a month or a week? I'm not talking about the magazine profile, right? Because obviously that's going to take as long as it's going to take. But you know, when I'm online, I do see you you know, rather frequently posting for the New Yorker's website. So I don't know if that's just you doing it because something is compelled to you, or you know, they ask you to do a certain amount of stories a month or something like that. How does that work?
Well, you're asking a question that we're working out, you know, as we as we talk, but that's something that we're working out right now is like, what is the sort of rhythm of our website? Not only of my writing, but what
cadence, they call it at The Athletic. What is your cadence? Yes.
What is our cadence? I mean, I have an overall expectation for the number of words that I'm writing in a year. So it's not done by piece. It's done by just like global words, and that, and it treats print words and website words the same. So in my case, I don't know, I actually am not privy to like other arrangements, but in my case, that's the sort of expectation. And so like what that looks like is we're sort of working up, like, you know, historically it's been like, oh, I have this idea, you know, and there are weeks where I write twice a week, and then there are months where I write like twice a month, you know. It's sort of been by the, like by the sports calendar, by my editor's availability, by, you know, when, how much like I said, I have small kids, like, are they, you know, both homesick that week? So that's, it's been a little bit more sort of like, slapdash in the past. And so now we're sort of trying to get into more of like, am I going to have like a weekly or a, you know, am I going to do like a weekly column, or am I going to do a, like write longer pieces, maybe, you know, twice a month, you know, and are they going to have a regular day? And I think we are moving toward that direction. Like in the past, this year so far, I've done mostly, or even into last year, sort of had this like Saturday morning, slot. And I'm not doing it like quite every week, but almost every week. You know, I should, once I get off the phone, I'm going to wrap up this piece and I'll have a piece tomorrow morning, is the hope. You know, I had one last, you know, Saturday morning, and, you know, it's sort of, that's sort of like the rhythm. And the idea is that we're going to get to a point where you can sort of expect a sports piece on the New Yorker on Saturday morning. And maybe it'll be usually me, or maybe my colleague Vincent Cunningham writes really beautifully about basketball and he loves it. Maybe he will do a basketball piece on the Saturday morning while I'm working on, let's say, a print piece or a longer, you know, a sort of like persons of interest profile, which is the web piece, but is not like the 1500 or 2000 word piece. Is like more like a 4000 word, you know, profile that would otherwise, is basically a magazine profile. So that could give me a little bit more space to sort of do some of these longer pieces that I want to do. So, but yeah, we are working on getting a sort of more regular cadence. So the readers sort of like have, I mean, the idea would be like, oh, there's Saturday morning. Like, let's see what Louise has to say about whatever she has to say. You know, it's sort of hard, like, because I think that, you know, it's not like a newspaper where you have an op-ed page and, you see a column, or even, you know, the old New York Times sports section had like a sports of the times kind of thing. And you sort of knew on Tuesdays or Thursdays or whatever. I'm not sure that people are ever going to get to the point where they're like, oh, it's Saturday, like, let's read Louisa. But it would be great if that were the case. And I hope maybe for some people it will be, like, that's really the hope. But yeah, we are moving toward a more regular cadence. I like that word. Thank you, Athletic.
That's cool. Can I give you a free New Yorker magazine pitch that I could see
absolutely
you doing?
And will you also tell people to read me on Saturdays now?
We'll do that. Yeah, read Louisa on Saturday. You know, it's let's make sure I have this right. Is it new, like yeah, it's newyorker.com, right? It's newyorker.com is
that is right. It's not the New Yorker, it's newyorker.com.
Yeah. Good, actually, whoever's doing the design on this, give them a raise, because it's actually very jarring in a really good way design.
Yeah, so we have a new design. The website has a new kind of new look.
Yeah, looks it's
new
cool.
New design, new cadence, pops. Like I said, a new kind of column orientation.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's kind of an exciting time to be.
It's like it looks like a magazine online, which is awesome. Like that's kind of how it pops. I'm sure that's what they. I'm sure that is the thing. All right, so here's my quick pitch for you. Again, this person has been profiled before. I don't believe they've ever been profiled by the New Yorker, and it sort of feels like a New Yorker story that your audience would like.
I love it.
In-depth profile of Dawn Staley. Go to South Carolina.
Oh yeah.
Figure out why she has been able to essentially create a dynasty down there in a fairly short amount of time. But more than that, her backstory is really fascinating. She was at Temple with no money. She won there. Obviously, she's one of the great point guards of her time. She's a black woman coaching college basketball, which is still a relatively new phenomenon from, you know, those who were coaching in the 80s and 90s. So she's just very interesting to me, and also just like is a respects the game so much, but is also a player advocate as well for her players. And so she's interesting. Anyway, just a quick pitch there.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, I mean, again, she's been done before. It's not like people write her every day, but she's the kind of figure, one, who I think would actually let you in, which is interesting, which is important in itself. And then two, I don't know how much the New Yorker audience knows about Dawn Staley.
Totally. Like, I mean, that's the thing, is it's not for us. We wouldn't want like a profile of Dawn Staley to come out at the same time that, I don't know, one of our competitors, I don't know, the Atlantic.
Actually, the off season would be the more interesting time for the New Yorker, as opposed to right now when the world will write about her.
Right. Because, and also, you know, as you say, she has an interesting, not only backstory, but sort of, you know, like role in this ecosystem. I mean, the way in which she's sort of been very vocal about making sure her players benefit, you know, financially from coming to South Carolina in a way that is very above board.
She may win this year, so that make her even more interesting story, because you'd be talking to a champion.
And to do it having like lost all of her starters last
year. That's right. Exactly. And
then,
and all her players now, not all her players, but many of her players now go on to be very, very successful in the WNBA. She was a pioneer when it came to the pros. She played in the old ABL. She's just interesting. And again, I while she's been profiled before, not to the point where she's sort of given everything up.
Seems like a classic idea. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Quick switch. All right.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady, a Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Let's finish up on this. You wrote a book about Louise Adams, the first lady of the United States from 1825, to 1829, correct? That's John Quincy Adams' wife?
That's John Quincy Adams' wife.
Okay. I'm fascinated by this, how someone approaches writing a book about someone who lived, you know, 150 plus years ago. Can you take, because you know, most of the people listening to this are obviously, it's a sports audience, but it would be the same process, like if you wanted to profile some, you know, I don't know, Cap Anson or somebody from like the 1880s who played baseball or something like that. So how did, like, what is the process of you researching and trying to figure out a book like this? I imagine it's like crazy library research and stuff. So how do you do it? How do you profile someone who passed away hundreds of years ago?
I have to say, it was more work than I thought it was going to be. The short answer. I had actually written a book about four brothers in World War I. My great grandfather and his three brothers. Two of them were pacifists and two of them were soldiers. I was a fact checker at the New Yorker and then an editor assistant. I left to write this book. And so I had some experience doing archival research, and I'd also worked as like a freelance researcher and fact checker on history books. And so I had some experience. Like I knew my way around archives. I knew how to request things. I knew how to read, you know, 18th century, 19th century handwriting, which is a really big challenge. And for people who haven't done it before, and I sort of knew some sort of like organizational kind of approach, but part of it is, as you say, it's like a little bit of a logistical challenge, just like organizing information and documents and, knowing how to read fast and what to read for. And it took 5 years. So that's the first part of it. When I did Conscience, it was a much smaller project. Even though I was writing about four people, I owned part of the archive. Like it was in my attic. And then there were a lot of like smaller archives that I visited around the country, that had some papers, but the Adams family papers, is just a huge collection and it's organized chronologically. Each person has their own little file. So Louisa Catherine Adams, her diaries and things like that, were in her own, you know, kind of like four reels of microfilm, which is pretty manageable. Although even that is like still a lot. But then the letters are chronological. So you have to just sort of sort through every Adams, you know, letter. And the Adams, the advantage is the Adams family. They're at the Massachusetts Historical Society, which is just like a phenomenal institution. I still kind of work with them as an advisor now. It's such a special place for American people who are interested in American history. But they have, all of these letters and records. And the advantage of writing about the Adams family is that they so kind of understood their place in American history and they kept everything. And they were all writers in some real sense. And part of what I was writing about was Louisa Catherine Adams becoming a writer. And she wrote so vividly and so movingly about so many kind of amazing, incredible moments in American history. And her kind of like ambivalent, you know, role in it. But I spent years actually just reading these letters and then also all this huge secondary source material, because so much has been written about them. And it was this mammoth undertaking. I ended up like making my outline was basically, a timeline actually. So I had this is probably more like granular than you were wondering, but I used this app called like Scrivener, which I actually have not sure I would recommend anymore because I had some like backup saving issues. But at the time, not on that project, fortunately. And I basically like had a whole like Scrivener, you know, file that was like each page was a year. And I just had a sort of coding system for letters. And I would like basically write down all the stuff that mattered to me. And then I would have, you know, I would have this code for like the letters to reference as I was sort of trying to write and outline and kind of get into the chapters more in a more focused way. And that was my sort of like organizing system, but it was a huge, huge undertaking. And it was like thrilling because it was so immersive. Like I just really started to like live with the Adams. I dreamed about them, you know, I mean, it was just sort of this like deeply immersive project. And in some ways I feel like that's the best way to write. I kind of miss it.
Yeah, that's a really great sort of description of that. And I think it gives people just a sense of like the kind of work, maybe the kind of obsessive work that you have to do in order to pull that off. All right, well, let's leave this with a fun one. All right, so it's March. French Open's coming up. Wimbledon's coming up. And the U.S. Open's coming up.
Are you going to be at the U.S. Open? Are you still getting some tennis in your life?
Now I live in Toronto, and it's a little, I try to pick my spots for The Athletic in terms of travel. And so sending someone there for 2 weeks who's not there, that the price starts to get high. So I wouldn't even make the ask. We have a very good tennis writer and tennis writers as well. So, but I do miss it. It was a great drive out. All right. So we have the three majors still coming up. Okay. This is going to be my fun one for you. There's, as you've seen already, we're starting to see a lot of chatter about, you know, is this the end for Djokovic? Was this because the dude lost at Indian Wells? All of a sudden now it's, you know, we'll start to hear a little bit of the stories. If I had to ask you, Louisa, to make a prediction, will Novak Djokovic win one of the three remaining last majors of the year? You'll be on record now because this is all taped, Louisa.
I think he will win one of the three majors.
Okay, I like that. All right. And my second one, okay, I agree with you, by the way. I would pick you.
Okay.
All right. Second one, how many majors will Coco Gauff win for the rest of the year?
Oh, for the rest of the year. Oh, good question. Gosh, you know, defending is so hard.
It's hard, especially on the women's side. It's very hard to predict.
It really is. I think Iga's going to win the French. So I'm not going to give her the French. You know, Wimbledon's like a little bit of a wild card for her, you know, just because obviously she's had some success on grass, but, you know, it's such a unique, I mean, who would have guessed like Vondrousova, like it's, you know, it's,
I know,
would
have won poor Jabeur. Year, so, yeah. Yeah.
You know, I don't want to say zero. I love her. I totally want this to be her time. And it can be her time. She's so young, you know. I think she's going to win the U.S. Open next year. Can I say that?
You can.
Can I fudge?
Sorry. So no, yeah. My answer is one. I think she will either win Wimbledon or the U.S. Open.
I'll give her one too. I'm going to give her Wimbledon.
French is tricky just because you have a really great clay court specialist. And it's just always a tricky tournament to win. There's a reason why we see people who win the French many times sort of have a unicorn run. All right. So, you know, we'll recheck back on this in September and see how we both did. Louisa Thomas is a staff writer for The New Yorker and their sports specialist, if you want to call it that. New Yorker is too august to say sports writer, but if you are interested,
sports critic,
right? If you are, you know, if you read that publication, and you should, obviously, still one of the great publications in the world. When you see a sports story, many times it will have Louisa Thomas's byline. And again, for those who are listening to this, I cannot recommend the Nikola Jokic piece enough. It's just like a masterful piece in terms of watching somebody and then informing the audience on that person's greatness without ever talking to the person whose greatness you're describing. Louisa, I'm a big fan of your work and I really appreciate you coming on this podcast today. Continued success and thanks for joining me today on the Sports Media Podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, back in the studio, my thanks to Louisa Thomas. That was fun. Certainly appreciate her writing and her time. If you want to head to the archives, there should be some stuff you like. Last podcast before this, covering Caitlin Clark. It's a college sports journalist, student journalists from the Daily Iowan, talking about what it's like to cover a transcendent athlete while you're a college journalist. Pablo Torre of Meadowlark Media and ESPN was on this podcast March 11th. Andrew Marsham, my colleague, The Athletic, on March 4th. Jason Kirk on his new novel in college football. Peter King was the guest of this podcast over the last month. Julie Kliegman on mental health and pro athletes. Sue Bird, Austin Karp, Kenny Smith. Noah Eagle, again, please leave us a 5-star review and a nice note if you like this kind of stuff. That's how the pod continues. Thank you to Patrick Antonetti for all his hard work. Thanks to everybody at Odyssey for their support. And thank you for listening. We'll see you soon on the Sports Media Podcast.
I'm Mark Chapman. Welcome to the Planet Premier League podcast. Each week, Cesc Fabregas, Nader Manua and myself talk all things Premier League.
As a player, you don't have time to talk.
No.
You don't have time to make a plan. You just need to deal with wave after wave after wave.
We watched Coach Carter and he said, oh, afterwards, the game's just about doing this for your teammates. And I remember looking around halfway through the film and half the squad was asleep.
Planet Premier League. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.